Well, according to the bell, it's time for us to begin. If you would please open your Bible to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26. Well, those of you that have been a part of this class for some time know that we've been studying the life of Christ for a long time. And Chris started this class, and he's not been here for over a year, so we're winding down to the conclusion of the study of the life of Christ. I mentioned to some others, I have a preference, and that's just all that it is. It's my preference. I prefer somewhat of a verse-by-verse contextual study rather than to study from questions. But it's always good to have questions to review and to look over and to cause us to think. And if you don't have a set of the questions, there's some on the table in the back. There's others over here, or are these future questions?
No, those are old questions.
Old questions, okay. So the ones you want are on the table in the back for this segment of our study. It'll be lesson 24, the last week of the life of Jesus, Roman numeral 6, if you are interested in picking that up on the table in the back.
This is class number 358.
Class number 358. Well, that's still less than a year, right? No, every day. 365 days. So, be that as it may. Anyway, in our study tonight, we're going to be looking in the text that you see on the board. I should have put that up there earlier. From Matthew's account, Mark's account, Luke's, and just a little bit out of John's account for the answers for these questions. This segment of our study is, of course, during the last week of Jesus' life, and in particular, after he has instituted the Lord's Supper in the observance of the Passover Supper in that feast that he celebrated with the disciples, the apostles. We know that the first question then is, where did Jesus and the disciples go after leaving the upper room? This is where he was when he instituted the Lord's Supper, where he observed the Passover in the upper room. Where did he go now after that? Anybody?
Gethsemane.
Gethsemane, yeah. Now, the Mount of Olives. Now, there's several passages. All of these deal with this. I want you to notice in Matthew's account, in chapter 26, verse 30, it says, when they had sung a hymn, they went out unto the Mount of Olives. Now, if you're familiar, and I think Richard and Linda, have you all been to this place, Jerusalem, and seen the Mount of Olives? All I've done is seen pictures of it. I think it'd be marvelous to actually see it. But for the pictures that I have seen, is the Mount of Olives is just that. It's a mountain or a hill where olives are grown, and it's across a great gorge from what I have been able to see in the pictures. Maybe not as big if you're standing there looking at it, but from the pictures it looks kind of like a gorge. And on the other side of the gorge is the city of Jerusalem. So he observed this Passover feast with the disciples and walked over into the Mount of Olives. Now, Mark's account gives us a little bit of more information. In Mark chapter 14, it tells us that they came into the place which was named Gethsemane. And he saith unto his disciples, sit ye here while I pray. And he taketh with him Peter, James, and John, and began to be greatly amazed and sore troubled. Luke's account, however, tells us in Luke 22, and this, I think, gives us a bit more information to at least to think about. In Luke 22, in verses 39 through 40, he came out and went as his custom was unto the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. And when he was at the place, he said unto them, pray that ye enter not into temptation. Now, John's account gives us just a little bit more additional detail. It says, when Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where was a garden, into which he entered himself and his disciples. Now, what I want you to be impressed with is, though you're reading three different accounts, they're parallel. And what we want to note, are four different accounts, though they're parallel, you gather just a little bit of information, additional information from each one. Again, I guess the thing that I want you to see in this is how to study. When you're reading in one account, you're looking for more information on the same point, which is covered in some of the other accounts. And by the way, not every bit of information is found in any one of them. So it's helpful to correlate them in some kind of an order, like we're doing, and the study of the chronological order of the life of Christ, the chronology. All right, any other questions on that? We know where he went. He went from the feast in the upper room to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he prayed. Number two, after telling the remainder of the disciples to wait for him, which of his disciples accompanied him farther into the garden? Which disciples? Linda?
Peter, James, and John.
And I find it interesting when we study of the life of Christ, as we have, that it seems that Peter, James, and John were among the closest of the disciples. They were with Jesus when he was transfigured on the Mount of Transfiguration in Matthew's account, chapter 17. And so to get our answer here, you'll notice Matthew's account. He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee. They're not named there. And began to be sorrowful and sore troubled. Mark's account names them, Peter, James, and John. Again, and began to be greatly amazed and troubled. For what did Jesus pray at this time? Now, one of the things we do want to know, we've studied the prayer of Jesus in John, the 17th chapter, where he prayed for himself that he might be glorified with the Father as he had been previous to his coming. And what we want to note in that is the preexistence of Jesus. Jesus existed in the form of God before he was born on this earth in a fleshly body. And so what we want to note that in this instance, we're reading of another prayer of Jesus from John 17. Here we're reading primarily in Luke's account. And Randy, would you mind to read that for me, please? Luke 22, 41 through 44. Luke 22, 41 through 44.
Luke 22, 41 through 44. And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw and knelt down and began to pray, saying, Father, if you were willing, remove this cup from me. Yet not my will, but yours be done. Now an angel from heaven appeared to him, strengthening him. And being in agony, he was praying very fervently, and his sweat became like drops of blood falling down upon the ground.
All right, we've got two questions here on number three. The first is, for what did Jesus pray at this time?
Let this cup pass
from me. What cup was it?
The suffering.
The suffering, yeah, the cup of suffering. Let this pass from me. But, he said, nevertheless, not my will, but thine be done. We want to call to mind a passage in the Hebrew letter. Those of you that have been in that class should be well familiar with this. In Hebrews chapter 10, beginning in verse 5, the context of Hebrews chapter 10 is contrasting what Jesus did with the shedding of the blood of bulls and goats. He pointed out that the blood of bulls and goats could not take away sin. It was necessary then, he says in verse 5, wherefore, when he cometh into the world, he saith, and here's a quote from the Old Testament Psalm, Psalm 40, sacrifice and offering thou wouldest not, but a body didst thou prepare for me. In whole burnt offerings and sacrifices for sins thou hadst no pleasure. Then said I, lo, I am come to do thy will, O God. Now that's the reading of the text without the parenthetical statement. I think sometimes it just makes more sense when you read it without the parenthetical statement, then go back and read the parenthetical statement. It tells us, then said I, lo, I am come, and then in the roll of the book it is written of me, to do thy will, O God. So he gives us a reference then from where this quotation comes. And so what we're asking is, for what did Jesus pray at this time? Well, he wanted this cup of anguish, the cup of suffering to pass from him. And that helps us, I think, to understand there was no other way that redemption could be accomplished without that. It also helps us to understand the humanity of Jesus. When we begin to look at Hebrews chapter 12, again, those of you that are in that class are familiar with Hebrews 12, verse 1, where there the writer says, therefore let us also, seeing we're compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses. Let's pause just there and comment that the great cloud of witnesses are those that's just been named in the 11th chapter. Then passing beyond that, he said, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. This passage is an impressive passage. Jesus looked beyond the suffering. We need to see that there was no joy in the suffering itself. He looked beyond that, knowing that it was necessary, it had to be done. There wasn't anything gleeful about being nailed to a cross, would there be? Would you find that something you would, with great anxious anticipation, look forward to? Well, no, not at all. And so Jesus prayed that this cup might pass from me, but there wasn't any other way possible for redemption to be accomplished without that. Now, maybe you remember a lesson not too long ago, probably about a month ago, where we were talking about the necessity of blood in the scheme of redemption. Remember that lesson? And we started out that lesson in Hebrews 9, verse 22, by noting that without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Can't have remission without blood. Now, when you read this passage in Hebrews chapter 12, we note that Jesus shed his blood, the anguish, the suffering of the cross. He looked beyond that to the joy that was set before him. That is, when he would be exalted at the right hand of God. But knowing that the suffering was necessary, there could not be redemption without it. Now, when you're studying with somebody in the scriptures, you want to hammer that point home. And there's a reason you want to hammer that home. Because if folks don't understand the sacrifice of Jesus, if they don't understand who he was, they don't understand what he did so that we could be forgiven and why that was necessary, then they're never going to see the horribleness of sin. Now let that hit bottom. If you want to see just how horrible sin is, you see Jesus dying on the cross. You let your mind drift to that and then know why we are called upon to remember that every first day of the week. We don't ever need to forget that image. Remember what was necessary because of sin that you committed. I guess when I was a little boy, I heard a preacher make a statement that has stuck with me all these years. He said, if you were the only person that ever lived, the only one, and you committed only one sin, just one, it would require the blood of Christ for you to be forgiven. That's how serious sin is. And when you multiply that times the many people that have ever lived and the many sins that we've ever committed, you see, God didn't just create a way where sin is just swept under the carpet and pretends you didn't do that. No. It required the blood of his Son. Now, what made his blood any different from yours? He's pure. That's right. He'd never committed a sin, not one. And so you have the just for the unjust, manifesting the mercy, the grace of God in sacrificing his Son. Now, that's implied in the prayer, let this cup pass from me. Now, just how serious was this? The second part of that question, number three. What indicated the intensity of his prayer?
Swept like great drops of blood.
I can't imagine that. Now, I've read, and you probably have too, commentators that indicated that from a medical standpoint that this is actually possible, that during times of tremendous stress, your sweat can have the, can actually come through the small capillaries of your skin in the form of blood. Now, I don't know about that. I've read that. I don't know about that. I'm not a doctor. I wouldn't care to speculate on it. But I would like to underscore the word as. That helps us to see that maybe it wasn't actually blood that was coming out in his sweat, as some speculate and say maybe that was the case. I don't know that to be the case. But what I do know is that word as tells us the anguish that he was in. And It helps us to focus, I think, our minds that Jesus was not joyfully anticipating the awfulness of the cross. Who would? What sane person would look to that kind of torment and agony of the cross? But that's what Luke 22, verse 44 tells us, Randy, and you read that. Now, you also read in that context the answer really to number four. According to Luke 22:43, who appeared to Jesus at this time, and what was the purpose of this appearance? Who appeared to him? An angel from heaven. And the purpose of that is stated in Luke 22:43, strengthening him. Is this the only time that angels ever cared for Jesus?
No.
Can you tell me another time?
The 40 days in the wilderness, the angels came at the end of it to minister to him.
Okay, very good, very good. So what we want to note here is, on this occasion in particular, was to strengthen him during this time of agony. Now, Richard, I got to ask you this question.
Oh.
Yeah. When we talk about an angel, what demonstrates what an angel can do?
Well, an angel took care of 185,000.
Did they?
Woke up dead that
Day. That was the army of the Assyrian Empire. And 185,000 of them woke up dead, as you said. And I think that's in about 2 Kings, about chapters 17 through 19, if memory serves me correctly, is where you will find that. And that's an impressive passage. Now, we're going to have occasion to talk about how many angels Jesus had command of. Anybody remember?
A legion?
How about 12?
Yeah,
12 legions. Now, how many were in a legion?
6,000.
You do the math. If one angel can wind up killing 185,000 Assyrian soldiers, and Jesus had command of 12 legions, that's 12 times 6,000. You think Pilate would have had any chance at all of defeating Jesus? Thus the point. When Jesus said in John chapter 10, "No man takes my life, but I lay it down. And if I lay it down, I can take it up again." Now, when Pilate was speaking with Jesus, we'll get to this later, but when Pilate was interrogating Jesus, he was pointing out to Jesus that, "Don't you know that I have the authority to set you free? And don't you know that I have the authority to take your life?" And Jesus said, "You wouldn't have any power at all unless it was given to you of my Father. Don't you know that I have within my authority to command 12 legions of angels?" Pilate wouldn't have stood a chance, would he? With all of his Roman army, he wouldn't have stood a chance. So Jesus submitted himself to that kind of a death. And when we look at this passage in Luke 22:43, an angel appeared to Jesus to strengthen him. We need to be impressed with what an angel can do. Okay? Any questions or comments? Randy?
Just a comment. The passage was in 2 Kings 19:30.
Thank you much. I thought it was in there somewhere. I kind of like to be right every once in a while. It is by chance, but I thought it was in there. Thank you. All right. I think the beginning of the fall of Samaria is the beginning of chapter 17, with the fall of Hoshea is the king's name. If I've got that right, let me know.
With all right. 185,000.
Pardon me?
With 185,000.
Chapter 19. Yeah. What did Jesus do when he found his disciples sleeping? When he found them sleeping the second time, the third time? Well, maybe we need to look at the text. Let's first of all look at Matthew 26. And again, Randy, I'll ask you just to read the text. There's no better way to answer this question. Just read the text. Matthew 26:40 through 45.
26:40-45. And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and said to Peter, "So you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour? Keep watching and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." He went away a second time and prayed, saying, "My Father, if this cannot pass away unless I drink it, your will be done." Again he came and found them sleeping, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them again and went away and prayed a third time, saying the same thing once more.
45, I'll get it.
Then he came to the disciples and said to them, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand that the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners."
Indeed. So, the first time when he found them sleeping, what did he say? "Couldn't you stay awake?" I find this passage especially interesting, perhaps even more than the other two, but when he speaks, he addresses this unto Peter. Now, do you have a clue why?
Could you say that again?
When he speaks in this first instance, it says he findeth them sleeping and saith unto Peter, "What, could you not watch with me 1 hour?" Why did he address that to Peter? I think it's indirectly addressed to all of them, but why did he say it to Peter? Jenny?
Verse 33, Peter's talking about how they all fall away because of you. I will never fall away. And then verse 35, even if I must die with you, I will not deny you. He's been very vocally vehement about his allegiance.
Yeah.
This is evidence that he is not prepared to follow through.
No, he's not quite there yet, is he? So he's made a very bold boast, we'll call it. And of course, right on the heels of some of those statements that Peter made, what had Jesus told him? We'll get to that in a little bit too. That's right. You'll deny that you even know me before the cock crows. You'll do it three times. Yeah. So Peter was one that I like to call impetuous Peter. Often when questions were asked by the Lord, he was the first one to speak. And sometimes he spoke, as the old fellow says, he got his mouth into locomotion before he got his mind in gear. And sometimes we're guilty of that. And this illustrates that, I think, specifically so, that Peter had just not thought this through. There's another occasion where Peter spoke before he had thought things through. Can anybody tell me what that was? Linda? Yeah. On the Mount of Transfiguration. Peter had a brilliant notion. Describe all of that for me.
Well, there was Moses and Elijah and the Lord, and he said, "How about we build 3 tabernacles, one for each of you?"
Yeah. What a marvelous thought. Now that passage, we're mostly familiar, I think, with Matthew's account of that, Matthew 17. I would challenge you to look at the other accounts of that and compare them. Because one of those accounts, I can't recall which one, tells us that Peter didn't know what he was talking about. I found that interesting. But in the reality, what was he proposing?
Let's worship all three.
Worship all three? Now that was not a bright idea. So the Lord said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Hear him." Listen to him. Peter, he dropped the ball on that. He had not thought that through as much as he should have. So, let's talk about step number 2 and 3 when he found them sleeping. The second time, what happened?
He went back to the place of prayer.
All right. And then the third time?
Same thing.
All right. What's different about the third time?
Time to go,
yeah. He says, "Sleep on now." And the translation, Randy, that you're reading from worded that as a question instead of a statement, as I understood it.
"So you men could not keep watch with me for 1 hour?"
Yeah, verse
45. He says, "Are you still sleeping and resting?"
There you are. "Are you still sleeping and resting?" The American Standard Translation does not word that as a question. It says, "Sleep on now. Take your rest." So it's stated as a statement. Not necessarily the third time as a rebuke. And you're right, Carolyn, because the time has come. It's come. Yeah. Yeah. Now, number six. How did Judas know where to find Jesus? This is interesting to me as well. We know that Judas had gone to the leaders of the Jews and had made a covenant with them. The proposal was not theirs, it was his. What will you give me to betray the Lord? And, of course, they weighed out to him 30 pieces of silver. Now, he knew when and where that he would deliver Jesus. How did he know where Jesus would be? This was his habit. Yes, you'll see that in Luke's account, especially in verse 39, chapter 22, verse 39. He came out and went as his custom was unto the Mount of Olives, and the disciples also followed him. Now, those of you who participated with us in this study, in this segment, as we were doing the verse-by-verse portion of the last week of Jesus' life, you recall that in the last week of Jesus' life, he spent the night, most nights, where?
Up there at the Mount of Olives.
Well,
when he went to see where's he going to stay?
Bethany.
Bethany, yeah, in Bethany. Most likely at the house of Lazarus, Martha, and Mary. Now, stating that, what we note is before he ended the day and went to Bethany, what was his custom? To go to the garden. And likely to pray. And I don't think from what I have read that this garden was gigantic. It wasn't all that huge from what I have read. But it was a place that was private that he would go and he would pray. So this is how Judas knew where to find him. Who accompanied him? And I think the implications of that question is who accompanied Judas? I'm sorry?
That just clicked what you said.
Who accompanied him was the chief priests and the soldiers.
Yeah, the soldiers and the chief priests. Now, we note that Jesus was in the habit of going there with the disciples, but Judas came, it tells us in verse 3 of John's account, John 18. Judas then, having received a band of soldiers and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, cometh hither with lanterns and torches and weapons. So I suppose this question asked who accompanied him, one might say, well, who accompanied Judas or who accompanied Jesus? Perhaps the implication of the pronoun in the second part of that might be Jesus. Who accompanied Jesus? Well, his disciples did, and that was his custom. But I want us to take note of who was with Judas and why. When we look at the band of soldiers, the officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, I'm not so sure sometimes upon just initially reading that we know who these soldiers are. We know that the Jewish Sanhedrin court, the court itself consisted of about 72 people. And the court itself had their own soldiers and guards and all of that. So what you see in the garden now is a pretty good size, we don't know the exact number, but a pretty good size of folks that accompanied Judas to arrest Jesus. Randy?
John 18:3 says, Judas, then, having received the Roman cohort and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. There's a marginal reference next to cohort that says, normally 600 men.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that, but that's good to know. So we've got a large number of people that have come to arrest Jesus. Now, do you find, well, I'm about to answer the next question. Let's get the next one. Well, before we do that, how did he identify Jesus to them? I'm anxious to get to this next question. He kissed him. That's right. And that's what was a kiss during this era of time. It was greeting, kind of like shaking hands, an act of friendship and very close relationship. And so, indeed, Judas had been a friend, according to the Old Testament prophecy, that a friend would betray him. And so was Judas. He betrayed him. And he betrayed him with a sign of affection, a sign of greeting.
with kiss. Now, number seven. Upon seeing Judas and those who accompanied him, what questions, plural, did Jesus ask of them? What was the first one?
Who do you seek?
Who do you seek? Well, you think Jesus didn't know?
He knew.
He knew. Now, in John's account, he again asked them. You got that in verse 4, and you got it again in verse 7, John 18. Whom seek ye? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. Now, Luke's account, let's look at this. Luke 22. Luke 22, in verse 48. Jesus said unto him, now he's directing this to Judas, Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? Why would that be considered so shocking by Jesus? Linda, you're smiling. Why?
Well, I'm just thinking about the fact that, you know, he knows exactly what Judas is doing. He is not, you know, coming up to him, oh, it's so good to see you, you know, like what a sign of affection would normally mean. So he's telling him, I know what you're doing.
I know what you're doing, yeah. Yeah, it's strange that you would betray the Son of Man in this manner. But we know, as we've studied before, from the Passover, the observance of the Passover, the question was asked when Jesus said, one of you is going to betray me. And the question was asked, well, Lord, is it I? Lord, is it I? And who else asked that question? Judas wanted to know, Lord, is it I? Why, he'd already gone and made the deal. He knew who it was. And so Jesus told him, what thou doest, do quickly. Go, do it. Do quickly. And so he went, and this is his return, and he betrayed the Son of Man with a kiss. Now, I think sometimes that when we read these accounts, we're not just exactly impressed with how rapid fire some of these things are occurring. We know that he observed the Passover with them on Thursday night. He was crucified on Friday morning. So he concluded the observance of the Passover. He went into the garden and prayed. He talked with the disciples because they were asleep at least three times. And then we know that Judas and this bunch of soldiers come and they arrest him. And this begins then the very early morning trial before the Jews with Caiaphas, and then the Roman trial before Pilate, and by midday he was hanging on the cross. So this illustrates for us, I think, how quickly that these things are passing. I had another question on this point. Upon seeing Judas and those that accompanied him, what questions, plural, did Jesus ask of them? We know that he asked the question twice of them, whom seek ye? And then he directed a question to Judas, betrayest thou the Son of Man with a kiss? But then there's yet another question that we find in Luke's account in chapter 22. Anybody have that in your notes? Yeah, Randy?
Verse 52. Jesus said to the chief priests and the officers of the temple and the elders who had come against him, have you come out with swords and clubs as you would against a robber? While I was with you daily in the temple, you did not lay hands on me, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours.
Isn't that weird? You've come now to arrest me?
You can arrest me anytime.
Yeah, but now you come with swords, spears, staves, like you're trying to arrest a robber. Now, do you recall that Jesus had asked these people, which of you convicteth me of sin? Was there anybody that could point a finger at any sin he had committed? But yet they're coming after him like he was a criminal. Something else I find interesting about this statement that's made. You come to arrest me, but you come like you're coming after a criminal. I want you to look at the weapons they had. What did they have?
Swords and clubs.
Swords and clubs, staves, spears, these kind of things. For those of you who have talked with people who believe that the coming of the Lord to set up his kingdom, that that was his purpose, and he failed to do that, and as a substitute measure, he established his church instead. You ever talk with somebody who made that argument? Anybody? You've not had that argument made?
But they've not made that argument.
All right.
Those exact words.
Well, I've talked with folks who've made that argument in those words, that the church was not the purpose of his coming, that what he came to do was to set up an earthly kingdom and to make it, like we've discussed a number of times, like the Jews had preconceived that the Messiah would do, that he would set up an earthly kingdom and he would deliver them from the suppression of the Romans. And even being interrogated before Pilate, we're not quite there yet, but you'll note in chapter 18, verse 36, when Pilate asked him, "Are you a king?" Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it was, then would my servants fight. But my kingdom is not that kind of, it's not of this world." Right?
I can't understand why anybody would believe that. Because to believe that automatically means that Satan can thwart the plan of God.
Yeah, yeah, there is that in there. Yeah, I've always wondered about that myself, you know.
It makes no sense.
They probably in him coming back for and reigning for 1,000 years so they can have a chance to go.
Yeah, yeah, kind of a second chance deal. Yeah, I've read that too and talked to some who've made that argument, believe it or not. They've made that argument. But now here's my concern. That, number one, you think you can overthrow or thwart the plan of God. Well, the answer to that's no, you can't do that. But how much more sophisticated has our weaponry become? And they could not overthrow the plan of God with swords and clubs and spears. They couldn't do it with that. What makes us think that God failed at anything? Now, to answer that, I know that there are all kinds of millennial theories about what's going to happen at the second coming of Jesus. But to answer that about thwarting the plan of God and the establishment of the church being some kind of an afterthought, open your Bible to Ephesians. We've recently studied this. Ephesians chapter 3. Ephesians chapter 3. I want to begin reading verse 8, and we'll read down through verse 11. 8 through 11. In verse 8, the writer says, the Apostle Paul, writing from a Roman prison, he said, "Unto me, who am less than the least of all saints, was this grace given, to preach unto the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ, and to make all men see what is the dispensation of the mystery, which for ages hath been hid in God, who created all things." Look at it carefully now. "To the intent that now unto the principalities and the powers and the heavenly places might be made known through the church the manifold wisdom of God, according to the eternal purpose which he purposed in Christ Jesus our Lord." Underscore that. Eternal purpose. Did God have to, at the last minute, change his plan and build the church? Well, no, that was a part of his eternal purpose. That was why Jesus came, to purchase the church with his blood. And again, you can read that in a host of passages, but in particular, Acts 20 and verse 28, beginning. So, upon seeing Judas and those who accompanied him, what questions did he ask of them? Well, don't miss that one. "You come out against me with swords and clubs, like you're coming after a robber. Wasn't I with you every day at the temple, and you didn't arrest me then?" Now, we know that to be true, not only because Jesus stated it here, but we know why when we go back to the accounts. They wanted to kill him earlier, but why didn't they arrest him and kill him? His hour had not yet come. Who's in control? God is. Don't ever forget that.
The Ephesians passage brings to mind Acts chapter 2, in 22. And Peter says,
yep,
"Men of Israel, listen to these words. Jesus of Nazareth has attested to you by God with miracles and wonders and signs, which God performed through him in your midst, just as you yourselves know. This man, delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God, you nailed to a cross in the hands of godless men and put him to death. But God raised him up again, putting an end to the agony of death, because it was impossible for him to be held in his power. But what that says is, it was the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God that he be nailed to a cross.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that interesting? Of course, we know that that was prophesied by Isaiah about 750 years before. So no, it was not an accident. It was not thwarting God's plan. It wasn't an upset to the plan. The church wasn't some kind of a secondary plan. Got James and then Kara.
Well, Mickey, the ironic thing is, after all these points that we made here, is that these people didn't realize that they were part of that plan to make this happen. They thought they were fighting against him. God was using them to bring this purpose about. So, I guess in respect, to talk about getting played.
Well,
you're not going to fool God.
No, and of course we've seen examples of that before. Back over in what is it, Isaiah chapter 5, I believe it is, Isaiah prophesied about the Assyrian king taking the northern 10 tribes captive, and he said, though it is not his will to do so. In other words, the Assyrian king would not help the plan of God if it was within his power to know it. He wouldn't have done it. But God used him. He was an instrument, and of course these people who crucified Jesus were instruments in the hand of God to carry out his plan. Carol, go ahead.
Back in Luke 22, verse 53, when he points out, you know, in the temple there were all these opportunities, and he didn't lay hands on me. And here they come with, I forgot the number you said, 600 plus, you know, armed for one guy. But he says, but this hour and the power of darkness are yours. It's like he's saying, here you go, this, I'm allowing this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm giving it over to you. You didn't take anything.
No.
I'm allowing it.
No, it's I gave it to you. Time. Yeah. Yeah, the hour has come. Exactly. Very good. Very good. Well, we've got seven questions up here. Let's see if we'll get number eight. Yes, I'm sorry.
I'm wondering, isn't the story of Adam and Eve an example of Satan thwarting God's plan?
No, not really. That's a good question. I don't know if I've ever really thought of that way before. But when we look at Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, the plan of God was that salvation, and we know that that plan of salvation was an eternal plan, as we read over here in Acts 2 and Ephesians 3. And that raises an interesting question. Did God know that man would sin? There was always that potential. But whose choice was it? Yeah. And that's a choice that we all make, which tells us that though God may have known that they would, he had the ability evidently to choose to leave this to them. It's your choice. And they did. They chose to commit sin. That's a good question. I don't know if I'd ever thought of that or not. I think the idea, though, behind it is intriguing. That here's sin that's presented before man. And, you know, you can live in the garden. You can partake of the tree of life and live forever, or you can choose not to. And they chose not to. So I don't know that I would say that they upset or overturned the plan of God, because his plan of redemption was eternal. I'll have to think on that some more. Matter of somehow how you word that gets my attention.
Satan was created by God. Satan is not eternal.
Satan, that's correct. That's correct.
He is a created being, just like the rest of us. But we don't find scripture that tells us why he was created. So it automatically puts it in the realm of speculation. And we can speculate that the reason God created him was so that we could have a choice. We have temptation with him. He offers lies and temptation. But if there were no temptation, if there were no opportunity for us to sin, then we wouldn't have free choice. We wouldn't have free will.
Well, there's truth to that. But I think to Tyler's question regarding the eternal plan of God, we know that it was to provide redemption. All along, it was God's plan to save man, to provide a way out so that you don't have to bear the awful consequence of sin. And it was an eternal plan. So before time began, this was in the mind of God. So I don't know that I could say that Satan, or that Adam and Eve, rather, thwarted the plan of God, because his plan was eternal. But at the same time, we've got to give Adam and Eve choice. They did what they wanted to do, and consequences followed. Okay? We could talk a little bit about the origin of Satan and all of that, but I think that'd take us on a tangent that I wouldn't have time to answer. So I want to look at this. Briefly summarize the events which took place during the arrest of Jesus. Now, I'm going to underscore that these questions are not mine. And it says briefly. So we're going to try to do that in brief. Okay? And notice, if you will, we've got the betrayal. We've got the betrayal kiss. We've got him being betrayed by a friend, which Psalms 41 says that he would. That was 1,000 years before Jesus came. We've got Jesus being defended during this time of arrest by Peter, of all people, as Peter drew his sword. Now, when Peter made the statement, "I'd die for you before I would deny you," I don't deny that Peter meant that. I think he did. I'm persuaded that he meant just exactly what he said. And here you've got all these soldiers, 600 soldiers perhaps, in front of Jesus and the disciples. And Peter drew his sword. He's going to take them all on. Now, if it meant dying, he's ready to do it. But here's the problem. This was not the goal for Peter to come to the rescue. Jesus was going to deliver himself up. And, of course, Jesus had authority to be defended, as we pointed out, by 12 legions of angels, Matthew 26. And so we've got a whole lot of folks. And Jesus had the command of all these angels. And then you've got the arrest of Jesus and him being taken, first of all, before Annas and then before Caiaphas, the high priest of that time. All right, so that's number 8. Number 9 will be the next question. Okay, so I'll put a star for that. Or you, Richard, number 9. All right, that's all for tonight. Thank you. Good question, Tyler. You've been thinking on that. I appreciate that.